This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Con Fringe reading series. Okay, it's time to get going with the second part of our entertainment for the evening, which is going to be a well-known local favourite of ours, Mr. Gareth L. Powell.
I've made a fundamental error. I've left my reading glasses at home.
Do you want to borrow mine?
No, I shall squint, but we've got quite good light here. A year ago, the last of the Monkey books came out, so I'm not going to read any of those. It's years ago. I've written three novels since then. And what I'm going to read for you tonight is the first two chapters of what I hope will be the first one to actually see the light of day. I've gone back to my first love, which is space opera, and it's called Gallery of Knives. At least that's what it's called at the moment. It might change, obviously, before it comes out, but at the moment it's called Gallery of Knives. Each chapter is narrated by a different character. This first chapter is narrated by a lady called Sal Constance. I hear knocking. Still crouched, Alva Clay rocked back on her boot heels and lowered her goggles. I'm guessing at least two people. I turned my head away as she fired up her cutting torch. Hey George, I called. We found some more. Get over here. Back towards the stern of the drifting wreck, George Walker, instantly recognisable in his bright orange medical jumpsuit, glanced up from the stretchered patient he had been tending. Yes, Captain. He lumbered towards me, his old man gait unsteady as the deck groaned and flexed on the swell. We've got more survivors, I told him. We'd already pulled four bodies from another hole Clay had cut in the top of the crashed scout ship, but only one of them had been alive. Right now, the hobo wallowed in the sea, with only a few dozen square metres of its upper structure still protruding above the waves. A metre from where I stood, sluggish wavelets, tinged pink by the sun, lapped at the edge of the hull. I rubbed my forehead. How had this happened? The hobo had been surveying the planet for possible colonisation. How had these idiots managed to land in an ocean and flood their entire vessel? My ship, the Trouble Dog, stood a few hundred metres to the east, hanging in the air like a monstrous bronze bullet. Before she had joined the House of Reclamation, the Trouble Dog had been a Carnival-class heavy cruiser for one of the more powerful human factions. Engines accounted for 85% of her mass. Weapon emplacements, sensor blisters, drone hangars and empty missile racks interrupted the otherwise smooth lines of her streamlined hull. How are you doing, ship? I asked her. Speaking through the bud implanted in my ear, the Trouble Dog said, I have been unable to recover the hobo's primary personality. I have accessed its core, but it appears to have erased its higher functions. I frowned. No black box. Why would it do that? According to its last status update, it blamed itself for the crash. Clouds were massing on the horizon, threatening to blot out the low, bloodshot sun. A sea breeze ruffled my hair. I pulled my flight jacket closed and sealed the zip. Isn't that unusual? I'd never heard of a ship's personality deliberately committing suicide. It's these scouts, the Trouble Dog said. They spend too much time out here on their own, and it drives them to peculiarity. I watched the ripples gnaw the edge of the hobo's mostly submerged upper surface and shrugged. None of this was our concern. All we had to do was recover the bodies, living or dead, and get them back to Camrose Station. When that had been done, other people, safety investigators and claims adjusters, could worry about the specific causes of the accident. What about the rest of the ship? I asked. Still filling with water, the Trouble Dog said. I estimate no more than 15 minutes until it finally submerges. How deep's this water? 1,500 metres. I peered over the edge. Fish-like shadows skittered and scattered beneath the water. Their flanks flashed like silver knives. Larger shapes stirred in the depths below. Plus, there's a storm front coming in from the east, the ship continued. No more than 10 minutes. Then I guess we'd better get a move on, huh? I turned my attention back to Alva Clay. Did you hear any of that? Clay had tied back her dreadlocks with a frayed and oily bandana. She wore heavy gauntlets to protect her hands and wrists, but her arms were bare, displaying the tattoos she'd earned during the archipelago war as a foot soldier in the sentient jungles of Pelopatan. Her dark goggles reflected the flare of the torch in her gloved hands. Where the flame touched, sparks fountained from the hull. I'm cutting as fast as I can, she said. Cut faster, unless you want to get your feet wet. Even after all this time, her tat still bothered me. I had my own share of ghosts, but I kept them to myself. I didn't feel the need to parade them for the entire world to see. The knocking from inside the stricken craft had ceased. If the people trapped in the compartment below had any sense, they would be cowering away from the flame and the 50-centimeter-wide plug of hull metal that was going to fall inward when Clay finished cutting her circle. George Walker unshouldered his medical pack and began to unroll a pair of self-inflating stretchers. His thinning grey hair appeared pink in the rubicund sunlight. Water lapped at his scuffed plastic boots. Careful, I said. Don't get too close to the edge. I don't want to have to pull you out. The old man's eyes crinkled in amusement. He thought I fussed too much. He had served as a medical officer aboard the Trouble Dog during the ship's military days, and had stayed aboard when she was decommissioned and transferred to the House of Reclamation. On my first day as captain, he'd been the one to give me the tour of the ship, and he'd shown me the secret nooks, patches and workarounds that only someone who'd lived and served on the ship for years could have known. Apparently, I reminded him of his daughter, a lawyer living in Berlin with two kids and a crippling mortgage. I'd met the woman once, during an unscheduled layover, but hadn't been able to grasp any similarity. Whatever had led the old man to conflate his feelings for us was beyond my capacity to fathom. Don't worry about me, Captain, he said. You concentrate on getting us out of here before the whole mess sinks to the bottom. I cast a wary glance at the horizon. I did not like the look of those clouds. I'll do my best, I promised. By the time Clay's circle was complete, the wreck had settled lower in the water, and the wavelets had advanced another 0.5 meter up the deck. The breeze had begun to pick up. Time was running out, and we all knew it. We weren't carrying the equipment necessary to operate below the surface. If we could get these two out, they would be the last survivors pulled from the hobo, before it took that long, final, spiralling fall into darkness and silence. The rest, if there were any, would be lost. We had done all we could. Clay switched off her torch and laid it aside. Captain, she said, do you want to do the honours? Thunder growled in the distance. Those clouds were the leading edge of the oncoming storm. The circle's molten outline burned like an ember. I raised my right boot and stamped down on its centre. Metal cracked and scraped, and the entire section fell away, splashing into the seawater, flooding the compartment below. For a moment, we stood paralysed, waiting for a movement. A voice. Anything. Then Alva Clay swore, and slid through the hole, boots first. When she reappeared moments later, puffing and blowing air and water from her lips, she had her arm clamped around a young man's neck. They were both kicking to stay afloat. I lay on the wet deck and reached down, and with Walker's help, managed to pull the kid up into the sunlight. We rolled him onto a stretcher. Is he breathing? A sudden wind blew across the deck, chilling my exposed skin. Walker checked the kid's pulse with one hand, waved me away with the other. Go on, he said. I've got this. I left him bent over the stretcher and slithered back to the edge of the hole. Lying with my head and shoulders hanging over the rim, I could see Clay's flashlight cutting this way and that through the shadowy water below. Her movements stirred up clouds of junk. I saw objects whirl through the circle of daylight thrown by the hole. A plastic fork, a comb, an empty cup, a loose shoe. Another clap of thunder rolled in from the horizon. If we'd had more time, I would have sent a drone in to help her. As it was, we were already pushing our luck. When Clay reappeared a second time, her dreads were sodden and plastered to her head, and her goggles were missing. "There's something in here." She lunged upwards and grabbed the lip of the hole. "Get me out." I took hold of her wrists. "What are you?" "I'm not kidding, Sally." She tried to pull herself up. "Get me the fuck out." I didn't argue. In the 3 years I'd known her, I'd never seen Clay this rattled. I'd seen her tense and anxious, maybe, but never actually afraid. I dragged her up with all the strength in my arms. Then, when she was halfway out and levering herself up on her elbows, I reached down and grabbed her by her tool belt. I pulled back hard, and she slithered up on top of me. Her clothes were soaked and dripping, and I tasted salt water. We rolled apart and sat panting on the wet deck, while lightning danced like fire among the clouds, and the quickening wind delivered the first spots of rain. "Where's the other one?" I asked her. Clay swallowed, trying to control her breathing. "Gone." I climbed to my feet and scrutinized the circle of darkness. "But there were two. Something took him." She wrapped her arms across her chest. "What was it?" "I don't know." Her chest rose and fell, but it was big and fast. "Like a shark?" With one of the submerged airlocks left open, I could see how a big fish might have wormed its way into the hobo's drowned interior. "No." Clay shook her head. "No, it had tentacles." She stood up and drew her pistol and backed away from the hole. I took one last look into the depths of the flooded cabin and then did likewise. Another peal of thunder split the sky. Although the clouds were still some distance from us, the rain rode ahead of them, blown like spittle. "We need to leave." Clay had a gun trained on the hole in the hull, as if expecting some aquatic horror to rise up from within. She was scared, but she was right. The weather was closing in and the hobo was in danger of dropping out from under us at any moment. We were out of time and we needed to evacuate the survivors, pronto. I opened my mouth to order the trouble dog shuttle to come pick us up, but stopped as I heard a splash behind me. I turned in time to glimpse something orange being pulled beneath the waves. At the same moment, an alarm pierced my ear as the trouble dog clamoured for my attention. Clay heard it too. She risked looking away from the hole for an instant. "Hey," she said, her face mirroring my confusion. "Where's George?" Chapter 2 is narrated by a different woman called Ona Sudak. Despite being kept awake for most of the night, I forced myself to get out of bed at 0600 hours, same as every other morning. Without waking Adam, I slid from the sheet and pulled on a robe. His gently snoring body lay like a bony xylophone. Loosened from its ponytail, his hair spilled down across his youthful face. His fake leather trousers had been carelessly tossed across the back of one of my chairs, and one of his boots, having been kicked away in the impatience of passion, now wallowed upended in my metal sink. I thought about kissing his forehead, but didn't want to wake him. I had my morning routine, and I didn't want him getting in the way, so I stepped out of the cabin and closed the door as quietly as I could. The corridor outside opened onto a deep shaft, maybe 50 metres from top to bottom, and half that again in width, bordered on all sides by balconies and hanging gardens. The air was sweet and pleasantly warm, and smelled of roses and rich mossy soil. Birds and butterflies flittered through the empty spaces. Bees fumbled among the flowers. I stood for a few moments drinking all of it in. One day, I intended to write a poem about life on the dam or one of her pen-shaped sister ships. One day, but not today. Fastening the robe's sash in a loose knot, I made my way to the nearest transport tube and descended half a dozen decks to the gym. Every morning, without exception, I did an hour's exercise before breakfast. It was a habit ingrained after long years in the... I caught myself before completing the thought and turned my intention instead to the waiting treadmills and weights. By 0700 hours ship's time, my muscles were cooling after a strenuous workout, and I was in the process of recovering in the pool, contemplating the distant glimmer of the dusty stars beyond the large picture window occupying the whole of the gym's back wall. In a couple of hours' time, we would make a close approach to the brain, the first of the objects we were to encounter. The Geest van Amsterdam hadn't wanted to linger in the gallery a moment longer than necessary, but the other passengers and I wanted to get a closer look at the objects, and we had been most insistent. Quite apart from the fact that the gallery lay in a disputed tract of space, the dam had its itinerary to consider, and strict adherence to schedule had always been a matter of pride among such vessels. Nevertheless, when Captain Benton finally interceded on our behalf, the ship reluctantly agreed to extend our presence in the system long enough to perform a close flyby of the Brain, the Inverted City, and the Dodecahedron. We were overjoyed. Like most of humanity, I'd only seen second-hand footage of the objects, so the opportunity to see three of them with my own eyes seemed like the kind of opportunity that strikes only once in a lifetime, the kind of experience one might relate to a grandchild. When the ship made its announcement, I was delighted by its concession. After 7 weeks of careful flirtation, I'd finally allowed myself to be seduced by the young poet, Adam LaRue, who had been pursuing me with a gauche and tragic fervour for the duration of the cruise, and I looked forward to viewing the mysterious sculptures in the company of my youthful paramour. I wanted to see them through his eyes. His delight would be purer and more childlike than anything I felt capable of mustering, and I would use it in the poem I intended to write about the encounter, recycling his sense of innocent wonder as my own. Adam was 18 and a half years old, with the gangly awkwardness of an adolescent, yet he affected a world-weary disdain for what he termed the mundanity of ordinary existence. He had been born and raised on the dam, and had seen many worlds during his short life, but mostly through the windows and viewscreens of his suite. He had little experience beyond the safe environs of the ship, and even less experience of women. He was very different to the other men I had known, and I guess that novelty was one of the things about him that attracted me. It certainly wasn't his poetry, which was execrable, full of extremity and unnecessary drama, and lacking the subtlety an older mind might have brought to its subjects. Had the cruise been shorter, I would never have welcomed him into my bed. Even now, wallowing in the warm, chlorinated water, I wasn't sure I hadn't made an embarrassing mistake. He was so much younger than me, for a start, and he wanted me to teach him everything I knew about poetry. I could have done that in about half an hour. Over the past 3 years, I had published a handful of epic poems to somewhat rapturous and unexpected applause, but none of them were what I'd consider to be masterpieces. They weren't poetic. On the contrary, the language I had used was almost clinical in its plainness, and the poems themselves were stark and guilt-laden, and not written for mass consumption. And yet their simplicity and lack of pretension seemed to catch something in the mood of the post-war public, giving voice to all their lingering feelings of loss and remorse. And, quite to my surprise and dismay, I found my artless words celebrated across the generality and acclaimed as the voice of a lost generation. Looking back now, I knew I should never have published, not even privately, but I could not have known that a well-meaning friend would post my poetry to a system-wide literary server, or that those words would have such appeal to the readers of the generality. I'd meant them as a small, private tribute, like funeral ashes scattered into the ocean of culture. Instead, my unanticipated readership saw in my retelling of old works a new political hope and a rejection of the territorial posturing that had led us to the archipelago war. Quite by accident, I had become a figurehead, a symbol of regeneration. But all I really wanted to do was disappear and forget the war. I didn't want to keep talking about it in interviews. I was sick of seeing my face on newscasts and literary feeds. All I wanted was to forget the whole thing, which is why I was looking forward to seeing the objects. 10,000 years ago, the solar system we now knew as the Gallery had been a remote and unremarkable place, just a small yellow sun with 7 perfectly ordinary planets. Then, sometime around the dawn of the 4th millennium BC, those planets had been carved into 7 immense sculptures, and nobody knew why or by whom. Arriving on the scene 6,000 years after their fashioning, human explorers had named the carvings according to their shapes. Counting outwards from the sun, they became known as the Teardrop, the Jagged Bolt, the Brain, the Inverted City, the Dodecahedron, the Flared Goblet, and the Broken Clock. Even now, their significance remained a mystery, but as they had endured for so many centuries, I hoped I would be able to find among them a way to throw my personal history into some sort of perspective. Through contemplation and the act of writing, I hope to stack my handful of days against the vastness of 10,000 years, and thereby exorcise their pain. And maybe, by seeing the object through Adam's young eyes, I could achieve that. The brain was a fat ovoid the size of Mars. Like the other objects, it had started life as a reasonably commonplace globe. Then the sculptors, using some unimaginable technology, had reshaped it, etching deep and convoluted designs into its surface. The larger lines were the size of canyons, the smaller no wider than a few centimetres. Together they formed an intricate, planet-sized labyrinth of exquisite complexity, with no identifiable beginning or end, no start or centre. My plan was to remain here in the pool for another half an hour, watching our progress through the window. I hoped the water and the mingled smell of chlorine and jasmine would soothe the remaining tension in my neck and shoulders and rinse away the fatigue from my workout. When we got closer to the brain, I'd return to my cabin and wake Adam. We'd get dressed and take a bottle of wine to the observation deck at the front of the ship, where most of the crew and passengers would be gathered beneath the transparent dome to witness our closest approach. I'd begun to drift off to sleep when the water quivered around me. At first, it was a pleasant sensation, like being rocked in a parent's arms. Then a second, stronger shudder wrenched me from my doze, and I gripped the side of the pool. The lights flickered. Beyond the window, I glimpsed a swarm of firefly sparks. Torpedoes! We were under attack, but by whom? And why weren't the alarms sounding? Why weren't we retaliating? The engines were off and even the air conditioning had stopped. The resulting silence was eerier and more terrifying than any amount of noise could have been. I surged from the water and grabbed my robe. A couple of teenagers emerged from one of the saunas looking perplexed, but I pushed straight past them, shoving my way towards the corridor. There was no time now to think, no time to warn anybody else. It was entirely possible, likely even, that I only had a few seconds of life remaining, and there were things I needed to do. Thank you.
And how long do we have to wait before that comes out?
10 years.
Darn. Oh, well. Okay, so let's take another short break now, if anybody needs another glass of beer or something, and we'll reconvene and put our readers to the question.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.